So tonight, for a few minutes, I want to talk about sharing love, which sounds kind of, I don't know, hokey a little bit, but my subtitle is You Can't Share What You Don't Have. And obviously, as Christians, we need to be loving, compassionate. Jesus himself said this in John 13, 34, 35, and this is point of thing, it's in the context, let me get my words out, that Jesus is talking to the disciples the night that he is later to be betrayed. So it's significant what he says, but it's also, I think, very significant when he says it. And so in this night, he says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, just as I have loved you. You also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you're my disciples, if you have love for one another." Now, speaking of context, in John 13, this is moments after Judas Iscariot goes off to do what he does in betraying the Lord. So I think it's a highly significant context to see. That's verse 21 through about verse 30, when Jesus says, "One of you is going to betray me," and they all say, "Well, is it me, Lord?" Even Judas, "Is it me, Lord?" And then he tells Judas to go do what you're going to do quickly, and then he makes this statement, "A new commandment I give to you." It's in the same context that Jesus washes all the disciples' feet, including Judas. Judas was still there at that moment in the first part of chapter 13. So it's not just some statement that Jesus makes, a new commandment, new like it's never been said before that we are to love. New, and the word from what I understand here, indicates more, more the idea that it's not new in nature, it's just new in the time that it's stated. And the idea has to do with Jesus is saying to his disciples, this is a significant thing for you to know now. As a matter of fact, in 1 John and in 2 and in 3 John, his letters, he says, the commandment we were given at the beginning doesn't indicate at the beginning of all time, but at the beginning of this new kingdom. And again, the new commandment was stated by Jesus in this really strange and difficult and challenging context. Where I want us to go for a moment and spend a little bit of time is in Ephesians chapter 4 and verses 1 through 16. I know sometimes we just read the first few verses, or we'll read verses 4, 5, and 6, or maybe even 11 through 16, but I kind of wanted to pick up the entirety of what he's saying, because what starts off in verse 1 is really continuing in the thought through verse 16. And as I have here before you kind of as a subtitle, unity of the body. And I did this on purpose, the unity of the body, because that's the point of the word unity. The actual subject, the force of the word is unit, the idea of things being together. So that's exactly what we're finding here in Ephesians 4. And this, by the way, is the same congregation that years down the road, Jesus addresses in Revelation 2 and says, you've lost your first love. Well, let's go here to see what the background of a statement like that would be. Ephesians 4:1, Paul says, "I therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you've been called." That's a significant statement right there. Live the way you've been called to live, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another. I think the New American Standard will say tolerating. That kind of, in our day and time, carries maybe a little bit more of a negative connotation. I don't think they intend it that way, but that's kind of the way things are now. But notice, it's not just bear with one another or tolerate one another, but to do so in love. Motivation for this is love. Eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call. One Lord and one faith and one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all, through all, and in all. But grace was given to each one of us according to the measure of Christ's gift. Therefore it says that when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives and he gave gifts to men. In saying he ascended, what does it mean but that he also descended into the lower regions, the earth? Now I'm at verse 10. He who descended is the one who also ascended far above all the heavens, that he might fill all things. And he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelist, the shepherds and teachers, to equip the saints for the work of service, for building up the body of Christ until, notice the duration, until we all attain to the unity of the faith. So he mentions unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace in verse 3, and then here in verse 13 he speaks about until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. He's the standard, basically. So that we may no longer be children tossed to and fro by the waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by human cunning, by craftiness and deceitful schemes. Rather, speaking the truth in love, and you notice the motivation of tolerating each other or bearing with one another is love. And then here, speaking the truth in love, we're to grow up in every way into Him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and held together by every joint with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love. So again, the motivation and the force, if you will, in verse 16 is that the body grows that it would build itself up in love. Now, Paul doesn't say all this just to say unity and love, but those are some of the focus words, if you will, that he brings out. The unity of the Spirit. Again, the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God to mature manhood. It's not just the idea that we grow. There's a point of maturity. So we move on. And that's kind of the point that he has here. But the thing is, the unity of the body. The body grows as it's unified, as it works together. All these parts, again, working together for the whole. Again, verse 15, 16. Speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up. And the idea, again, is that of maturity. So we are to mature in every way into Him who is the head, that is Christ, from whom the whole body joined and held together by every joint with which it is equipped. When each part is working properly, makes the body grow that it builds itself up in love. That's what God intends us to be together. It's not that we are alone together as somewhat, I guess, is the idea that is stated so much lately in our day and time. I understand why they say it, but at the same time, it's just, I don't like that. We're not alone together. We are to be together. I mean, this is the point in Ephesians. Look over to 1 Corinthians 12. He makes, that is, Paul makes the same point of the common good, that all of us, as we work together, are to work for the common good. So 1 Corinthians 12, verse 7, and again, more of a lengthy reading in context, but 7 through 27, and really we could go through chapter 14, and I say that because that's the context. In chapter 12, he's emphasizing their spiritual gifts, why they have them at all. God gave them to them for them to grow, and what they've done is taken the least helpful, which would be the speaking in tongues. They seem to have made that the most important. As we get to the end of the chapter 12, we'll see that. And then he moves into the discussion about love, which is exactly the point we're trying to make here. The very statement overall is that sharing love, that's what we got to have first to be able to share it. So in verse 7, to each is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. Again, it's for the common good. It's not for you and you alone. It's to be shared. So in verse 8, he says, for to one is given through the Spirit the utterance of wisdom, and to another the utterance of knowledge according to the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, to another gifts of healings by the one Spirit, to another the working of miracles, to another prophecy, to another the ability to distinguish between spirits, to another various kinds of tongues, to another the interpretation of tongues. All these are empowered by one and the same Spirit, who apportions to each one individually as He wills. For, just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. Are all these members? Just like in our own body, and He's going to use the human body as an illustration. So He goes on here in verse 13. In one Spirit, we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, and all were made to drink of one Spirit. For the body does not consist of one member, but of many. If the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I don't belong to the body. That would not make it any less a part of the body. If the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I don't belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. Can you imagine the revolution if your body said that? If the whole body were an eye, then where would be the sense of hearing? If the whole body were an ear, then where would be the sense of smell? But as it is, verse 18 is one of those verses in a number of my Bibles I've underlined or at least highlighted. As it is, God arranged the members in the body, each one of them as he chose. So whatever abilities we have are for the common good. Again, verse 7 says that. But the point is, whatever abilities we have, whatever gifts God has given us, yes, they're for the common good, but yes, also it's God who's given them. So it's not a competition at all. It's every part working together, as he says in Ephesians 4:16, every part working together to cause growth. That's the point. So here in verse 18, God arranged the members in the body, each one of them as he chose. Now, if all were a single member, then where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, and yet one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. So earlier he makes the argument, one part of the body may say, because I'm not that part, then I'm not part of the body. He changes, if you will, the viewpoint here of an eye saying to the hand, you don't belong, you know, I don't need you. And again, the head to the feet, I don't need you. On the contrary, the parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And on those parts of the body that we think less honorable, we bestow greater honor, and our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty, which our more presentable parts do not require. But God has so composed the body, and this is basically a restatement in verse 18. So verse 24, God has so composed the body, giving greater honor to the part that lacked it, that, here's the reason, that there would be no division in the body, but that the members would have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, then all rejoice together. Now, you're the body of Christ and individually members of it. And God, and I'm going to read on. I have verse 27. I want to read on through 13:8 on purpose because that really is the fuller context of love. God has appointed in the church first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then miracles, then gifts of healing, helping, administrating, and various kinds of tongues. Now, his point basically is this. Tongues aren't number one. Y'all have put them up, and they're not number one. He'll make that point more in chapter 14, but here he elevates, as God has appointed in the church first, apostles. So the teaching and the deliverance and the revelation. So as he goes on here in verse 29, are all apostles, are all prophets, are all teachers, do all work miracles, do all possess gifts of healing, do all speak with tongues, do all interpret? And obviously it's a rhetorical series of questions and that's the point. Not all are. But earnestly desire the higher gifts. And I will show you a still more excellent way. Well, what is that excellent way? That more excellent way? And he says what it is, if I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. When I was in high school and in college, I was performing some in band, orchestras and symphonies. When in high school, I did that a whole lot more. I cannot imagine, truly, some of the pieces that we played where there's, you know, the real quiet, and it's just a nuanced, and then some noisy gong just going at it, you know? It just doesn't fit. It would get everybody's attention, obviously, but it would be more of a startling thing than anything else. The only place and the only piece I remember that we played anything like that where that happened is a Charles Ives piece, his Second Symphony. If you don't know anything about Charles Ives, you're probably better off not. He's an American composer from the early 20th century who just... I get chills talking about him because he worked in tones that were really hard to listen to. And he did it on purpose. I've got a CD if you want it. And listen to it, it'll put your teeth on edge. And it's like, why? Well, because he could. And he was just expanding. The Second Symphony, I will say this, I do like it because there's a lot of really good stuff in it. And then all of a sudden, there's this clanging cymbal. And where he got the idea of a clanging cymbal is from 1 Corinthians 13, because that's what he wrote. He said, in the midst of the beauty comes the lack of love, comes the lack of compassion, comes the lack of brotherliness and all that. He goes on and on about that. But again, Paul says, you know, if I'm able to speak even with tongues of angels, but I don't have love, then I'm just a noisy gong and a clanging cymbal. If I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, it's not like he has an understanding in this. He's speaking in extreme ways. If I can do it all, even if I have all faith, even to remove mountains faith, but if I don't have love, then I am nothing. If I give away everything I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but I don't have love, then I'm gaining nothing. Love is patient and kind. That may be where we need to start and even stop. Love is patient and kind. And it's not just love is patient with any kind of adversity. The idea, as he's talking in this context of all these various gifts that they have, is that they work together. That's his illustration beginning in verse 12, going through most of that section in chapter 12, is, again, every part working together. You know, the hand can't say this and the eye can't say that. Where would the body be if it were just one member and all of that? So now he's saying that love is patient and kind. Love doesn't envy. Love doesn't boast. It's not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It's not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing. It rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. Now he goes on, of course, making the point there are the things that do end, but love doesn't. This is a hard passage, and not because we don't understand it. It's hard because we do understand it, and we understand how we might fail in some of the things that he's talking about here. We need to work on this, every one of us. It's not, you know, it's not the easy thing to do, and it's a lot easier probably to sit there and think, well, yeah, I know so-and-so, they need that. That's kind of the design of our adversary, Satan, who thinks he can get our ear and our brain and say, well, yeah, so-and-so, they need this. This section here, oh, yeah, they need that. But the point I think the Lord is trying to make through the apostle is that's what each one of us needs. As he says in verse 13, the very conclusion, so now faith, hope, and love abide. These three, but the greatest of these is love. And so he says in chapter 14, 1, pursue love and earnestly desire the spiritual gifts, especially that you may prophesy, which has more to do with preaching than we often think of that word prophecy in the sense of saying something that's yet to come. And there's a sense in that, but not entirely. And you may notice, I can't say this is the hard and fast rule, but the word prophecy with an S almost always means like preaching. And prophecy with a C almost always means to tell something that's about to happen. Like Isaiah talking about Cyrus, you know, he's raising up Cyrus. That's a prophecy with a C, not an S. Although, again, it's not a hard and fast rule every single time. The point that I want to make tonight somewhat is also this. Proverbs 18, 1 and 2 says that whoever isolates himself seeks his own desire. He breaks out against all sound judgment. A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his own opinion or his own mind. You know, we think of things like, no man is an island. You've probably heard that statement. It's a very famous statement. This is pretty much, I think, what chapter 18, verse 1 is saying. Except it's saying it more so anybody who tries to isolate himself from everybody else is seeking his own desire. He's not seeking to conform or to be together. He's breaking out against all sound judgment. I mean, that's the point. Being alone, not good. God didn't design us to be alone. Can you imagine heaven and it's just you? I know the song we sang, and I'm not picking on you at all, Andrew, but that song is about Mary, who sees the Lord immediately after his resurrection, and she walks with Jesus and talks to him, and it's a very intimate sort of scene. Now, the Bible doesn't say that all that happened, just that Jesus comes up to her, and she thinks he's the gardener, and, you know, she clings to him when she finds out who he is, and he's like, don't, I haven't been raised yet, you know. There's not this whole we walk and talk and whisper in each other's ears and things like that. It's just, I know it's a poetic idea connected to it. But there isn't this sense of it's just going to be me, the Holy Spirit, Jesus, the Son of God, and God the Father. It's just going to be us. I don't know about you. That doesn't sound heavenly. I mean, even God, when he created things as he wanted them in the Garden of Eden, didn't put Adam in there all by himself for very long. He gave him a help, suitable, a help meet. And there's Eve. And so we have an understanding, at least I think very early on, of this concept of family. Very early on, this is what God desires. This is what God has designed us to be about, is others. And how many passages throughout the Bible, I wouldn't just say Proverbs or even Paul, but are emphasizing the togetherness of things. Again, whoever isolates himself is seeking his own desire. He breaks out against all sound judgment. A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his own opinion. Well, let's think about what God says in 1 John 5, 1 through 3, about love. Ultimately, it conforms to God. That's the idea that we want to stress. Everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ has been born of God. And everyone who loves the Father loves whoever has been born by him or born of him. By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God. You see that? He doesn't say, we know we love each other when we love each other. He says, we know we love the children of God when we love God and obey his commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. And his commandments are not burdensome. They're not grievous, is probably the more familiar reading to us. Well, the point is, they're not against us. They don't cause grief. They actually, that is all of God's commands, not just about love and not just about being together and being united and not just those things, but all of his commands. The idea of singing is to be together, to encourage one another. We do that together. Partaking of the Lord's Supper, as we'll be doing a little later. It's, again, it's a together concept. It's not isolate. It's together. Again, as we read earlier, Ephesians 4, 1 through 3. I, therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you've been called. See your calling and follow that calling. Live the way you're supposed to, in a manner that is worthy, again, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love. I think that's one of the things we can talk about love a lot. But there's a sense of compassion that needs to be there. And I think that's what love is in a practical way. It's not just doting over somebody. It's being compassionate, putting ourselves in their place. And I think that's part of what he's trying to get at here. That's how we successfully bear with each other, is in love, by showing even compassion and prayer toward each other. I mean, if Jesus says we're to pray for those who persecute us, then certainly we need to be praying for each other as Christians, you know, brothers and sisters. And again, there's that familial relationship that he himself emphasizes. As he, you know, in his model prayer, when the disciples say, teach us how to pray, John's disciples were taught by John how to pray, teach us. And that's one of the most familiar things. Father, who art in heaven, you know, the old King James, Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And here's the point. It's Father. It's not God, you are so distant and we can't even say your name. It's Father. That's the family relationship. And then here, of course, he's trying to point that out. We are eager to. Eager shows zeal. Eager doesn't mean, all right, I'll do it because I have to. It's eager because we know we should and we want to please God. Again, we love the children when we love God and keep his commandments. Well, we do that. How many times growing up, if you have siblings, if you don't have siblings, you missed out. But if you have siblings, there are times when, you know, your parents yell at you, you guys, you know, don't know how lucky you are. You have each other. And I know usually the siblings at that moment are like, yeah, no. When I was growing up, I heard that fairly often. My brother and I would fight, not just, you know, yell at each other and call each other fat. That's kind of the girl thing, I guess. We would physically fight. And I remember Mom pulling us apart a few times and saying, you just don't know how lucky you are. And we'd look at each other like, she's insane. And when she turned around, we then hit each other again, because it's what you do. Of course, I was also the one when my brother and I were only in the same school, I think, for 1 year when I was in elementary school. He was a year ahead, and it just worked out that 1 year. And I remember he and I would fight. We get out of school, and you know how that is. Some kid starts picking on your brother. Well, you just were fighting your brother yourself maybe that morning. Oh, no, you step in, and you fight for your brother. And then I remember doing that just a couple times. And then a couple times I stood and watched. So I was not the best brother. And my brother reminds me of that every once in a while. You remember when? Yes, I do. I really do. Don't be that way. We're to bear with each other, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. I want to close with a passage I don't have here in Romans 8. Let's turn to Romans 8, verse 12 to 17. Talking again about the family. Everything about the family. That concept of family and together. And when we're not together, it's hard. There's no point of it being easy when we're separated. Romans 8, verse 12. And we're going to read through here, verse 17. Paul, through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, says, brothers, I mean, he starts right off, brothers, we are debtors, not to the flesh, to live according to the flesh. For if you live according to the flesh, you'll die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you'll live. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are sons of God. Notice, it's not just those who have in their mind the intention to be led. It's those who are led by the Spirit are sons of God. For you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear. You have received the spirit of adoption as sons, by whom we cry out, Abba, Father. The Spirit Himself bears witness with our spirit that we're children of God. And if children, then heirs. Heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with Him in order that we may also be glorified with Him. It's hardly any way for us to conclude a passage or a sermon, about love without the passage in John 3:16 that God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. It's not that God hated the world and so He gave His only begotten Son. There are religions who kind of teach that God just hates everything and hates everyone. He's a punisher, and that's all. The New Testament teaches us very clearly, and I would say really the whole Bible teaches us about God's compassion and His love. And John 3:16 is a famous passage, but it's a familiar one that we need to remind ourselves of sometimes, that God's motivation for sending His only Son to the earth to die was love. Love sent Him to the cross. He didn't go begrudgingly. I'm not saying there was no slight hesitation, because even Jesus, the night He was betrayed, said, let this cup pass, but not my will, thine be done. That's what we need, is our own concept every day, is God's will be done in our lives. Again, God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in Him would not perish, but have eternal life. You and I can have that. Being born again of water and Spirit, as He says in John 3, earlier in John 3, beginning in verse 3, going through about verse 7 and 8. And we can do that even today, according to God's commandment. And it's not just that. Again, as we started off the entire lesson, the idea is that of sharing love, and you can't share what you don't have yourself. It's a continuation. It's not just the one thing you have and you only have it one time. It's hopefully something that continues to grow forever and ever. And we want to share that love. We want to be compassionate where we should be. We want to be unified as we should be in accordance with God's will. The song we're going to sing here, number 149, Hark the Gentle Voice of Jesus Falleth Tenderly Upon Your Ear. Sweet His cry of love and pity. And pity is another word for compassion. In Matthew 18, the king, you remember, who was owed 10,000 talents by that one guy, showed pity. Again, sweet His cry of love and pity calleth. Turn and listen. Stay and hear. And if there's anyone here tonight that needs the Lord's love, come forward right as we stand and sing.